Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Thanks for the download. My guest today is Lawrence Moore, known as Loz. Loz served in the Cheshire Regiment, and on this episode we discuss his time at Sandhurst, what it was like to deploy in operations as a young officer in Northern Ireland, Iraq and Afghanistan. We then talk about the effects operations had on him personally, and why he helped set up Cockleshell 22 with a group of serving and former service people from across the Royal Marines, Royal Air Force and British Army. Cockleshell 22 aims to provide funded expeditions based on historical military raids and groundbreaking mentoring programs to the military community in order to improve overall health of its beneficiaries. Don't forget to like, follow and share details of the podcast and leave a review wherever you get your podcast from. It doesn't take long and helps bring it to the attention of a wider audience. Finally, if you enjoyed the content, you can help with ongoing costs like website hosting and buy me a virtual coffee via a link in the show notes. Let's crack on. Thanks for coming to the podcast, Loz. Can you start by telling us when you joined the Army, what made you enlist, why you chose the Cheshire Regiment?
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you very much for having me on. It's a real honour to be able to talk to you about my military experience. So my dad was in the Parachute Regiment and growing up, he'd tell me all these incredible war stories of the things that he'd been up to in the late 60s, early 70s. He'd gone in as a junior soldier, so at the age of 15 gone to Aldershot to junior para, and then over to Ireland, and that was his sort of experience. But he used to tell me about some of these fascinating characters as well. One who we've already been discussing was a guy called Costas Georgiou, who later became the notorious Colonel Callan. And so I wasn't too sure whether he was telling me the truth when he used to tell me these type of anecdotes, but I did research it. I looked it up and it was mostly true.
He was in a parachute regiment. He got booted out in Northern Ireland because him and the two of his mates raided a bank. They then went across to Angola and he headed up a mercenary force and he was killing people because they were cocking up in ambushes, that type of thing. And he was eventually executed, wasn't he, after a trial?
Yeah, so he tried to get my dad to go over and join him when they were in Angola. And I think it was at the point that he just met my mum. So he's in the phase of trying to settle down and probably didn't fancy going over stealing diamonds in Angola or whatever they were up to. And I think history sort of laid out that was the right choice in the end. I mean, when we consider sort of what mercenaries are, that was a proper mercenary army and they'd been recruited to go over and conduct a war. And I think that because you had an individual who probably hadn't had that leadership experience thrust into that position, he maybe got a bit carried away with himself and what he thought was acceptable. And even at the end, Margaret Thatcher tried to put a plea in to the Angolan government to stay his execution, but that wasn't successful. And like you said, he got executed. So just going back to that sort of reasoning behind me joining the military, I think it was inevitable. I used to sort of listen to these stories. He passed on to me a really sort of strong passion for military history. So I went on to study all the way up to university level military history. And that obviously stood me in good stead when I eventually went into the army and started to learn about international relations. And even now I'm a civilian again, very, very passionate still about that military history piece. And I think we can learn so much by looking back. I wasn't quite sure which part of the military I wanted to go into. Initially, I'd gone into the air cadets when I was at school. And even that for me was fantastic. You know, we were going out and we were wearing camouflage and crawling about. And there was guys that were leaving the squadron going into the regular RAF. So I decided to initially pursue that path and went down to RAF Cranwell and did my flying grading aptitude tests, and I was successful at them. So that would have led on to a scholarship for me to go into the RAF. But then growing up, teenage boy, started to not necessarily fall off the tracks, but experience other things as well. And then afterwards, when I'd kind of got to the point of going to university, someone told me when I was on the course that, you should probably join the OTC. So I was like, all right, okay, I'll go and do that then. And this is when I started to learn about SANDERS as well. So I wasn't really aware that it existed as sort of an organisation or an academy. So I went down to the OTC, but they said, oh, you're too late, you can't join us now. And I was like, all right, well, I'll go and join the TA instead. And it was the King's Regiment in Ardwick, Manchester. And it was absolutely fantastic to go and be a Kingsman. Really, really enjoyed my experience in the Territorial Army. I went on a load of exercises, met some really interesting characters. And this was at the beginning stages of the Iraq conflict, 2003 onwards. So there were guys that were in my company who were going out on those deployments, which we'll talk about later when we discuss Afghanistan. And I think it was a real good grounding in being a soldier, which stood me in great stead when I started to lead soldiers later on, because I'd been one, essentially, although within the Territorial Army. So that was why I wanted to go into the military. And then because I'd realised about Sandhurst being an option, and I thought, well, actually, let's do that because there's going to be less people telling me what to do. And it probably was as like naive as that what drove me to apply for Sandhurst. Probably didn't think I was going to get in, but I did. And you can tell by my voice, I'm not probably from the same background as a lot of people that go to Sandhurst, but they've obviously looked at my record, or maybe they wanted to have a bit of diversity, so they let me in. And the rest was history, really. It did give me an awful lot of grounding. I was able to bring a lot to the table in terms of leadership, certainly in a tactical level. It's kind of been such a formative experience for me to go to Sandhurst. I remember the first day that I went down there, my mum had driven me down, and you pull up on old college parade ground and you've got a load of colour sergeants with the red sashes on. Anyway, we've got whisked off one way, going showing our rooms and stuff, and all the parents were taken into an ante room so that they could have like tea and biscuits or whatever. And my mum comes and tells me afterwards when we bumped back into it, she said, she'd never guess what. I was like, what? She said, I was getting myself a cup of tea and someone comes up and taps me on the shoulder and says, excuse me, you couldn't tell me where the wine is, could you? She says, I turned round and it was Prince Charles, our future king. And so it suddenly dawned on us that not only was I at this incredible leadership academy, but also I was going to be spending the next year with the future King of England.
So what was it like once you started your training?
So you might have heard a saying about it being like Hogwarts on steroids, and it really was. I mean, the buildings themselves, they were a Victorian construction. It's got these Victorian traditions, which are very much carried through by the Guards contingent at Sandhurst. And it's split into school terms almost. So your first term is your soldier training condensed into 5 weeks, and it's very fast and furious and probably no different than what everyone else experiences when they go through depot. But then once you've ticked that box, it moves on a bit more to field leadership. So there's a lot of exercises, there's a lot of theoretical lessons, a lot about international relations and defence diplomacy. And then the final term's kind of giving you the polish, letting the reins off a little bit and making sure that as soon as you finish there, you're going to go and do some arm-specific training, but then you're leading men. And we knew, because of reading the papers every day, that we were going straight into combat operations. So there wasn't really any period that it was going to be a lot of time sitting in Germany going on adventurous training and stuff. It was primarily an operational army at that time. And so we were very aware of what was going to be happening. And I think this is like the crossover when you were sort of leaving and I was coming in. So you all know exactly the tempo of operations at that point. Going back to why I ended up in the Cheshire Regiment, part of the process when you're at Sandhurst is that you have to have a look at different parts of the army and which one that you'd most fit into. And I had a look at a couple of the other infantry regiments, but they'd said you can't just pick infantry regiments. You've got to go and do a familiarisation visit at the Royal Engineers, and went down to the Royal Artillery, and everyone puts on a good show, so they'll get out all of the best kit and equipment. But I went over to Ireland, to Ballykinler, to meet the Cheshire Regiment, and it was just an instant click. I think that the officers that hosted me throughout that visit, the type of people who came from the same area that I come from, Stockport in Greater Manchester, and a lot of the guys in the Cheshire Regiment come from there and over towards Liverpool as well. It was a really, really great group of people in the officers' mess. The CO at the time who'd interviewed me at Sandhurst just seemed like an incredible individual, and I know he's gone on right up at the top of the army now. So it was great time to be in that regiment. So I just felt entirely at home. And I actually became one of the final two officers to commission into the Cheshire Regiment, which was an honour in itself, because it's obviously got a really long and illustrious history. Because soon after I joined, it amalgamated into the Mercian Regiment, becoming the 1st Battalion. The only final piece that I had to do then was to go down to Brecon and do the platoon commander's battle course, which I think that's a great leveller as well, because maybe in different parts of the army or in different eras, the soldiers and the NCOs don't really get to look at the officers, and they perhaps don't have the greatest appreciation of what the officer brings. But when you've got corporals and sergeants getting thrashed about in Brecon, and then they see this group of officers who are brand new straight out of Sandhurst going through the same training, I think that really makes those individuals realise that if he can pass that course that I've just found really challenging, obviously got something about him. So I think it's really a smart move to make the junior, senior Brecon and platoon commander's battle course all operate from the same location. Because it's the same course.
No, it's a good idea. And the Royal Marines do something similar. They're quite lucky that all their officers and marine trains all done the same establishment. But after Sandhurst then, you're turning up to your battalion for the first time. And I imagine for any young officer, that's quite a daunting experience, because it's quite a fine line you've got to tread, because you'll be given your own platoon. You'll be given a platoon sergeant who'll be vastly experienced. He's there to mentor you, but it must be quite a fine line at times between not being too submissive and establishing your own leadership, but also being able to take advice from that experienced platoon sergeant. So what was it like turning up in a battalion for the first time?
Yeah, just to answer your question about that sort of place that you have to find yourself as a brand new leader, it's something that you think about a lot when you're at Sandhurst, and you think, how am I going to act? What am I going to say? Are the guys going to like me? Am I just going to crash and burn? And you see it happening. Some people become too familiar, too pally, because they want to fit in. But the problem is, I think with certain individuals, if you give too much, you're never going to get it back. So you always have to maintain that separation. And with that sort of infantry subunit operating model, it's quite a lonely place being in command, because oftentimes the platoon commander is in an isolated location with no other officers, having to maintain that separation from the blokes that you've trained and worked with. But you have to do it, because ultimately when you're at the point that you've got to ask these individuals to do something pretty sketchy, like run across an open field under fire, that has to be an instantaneous response. And so that's why you have to always keep this separation regardless. And I think you just accept that as a leader, it will be lonely at times. So you have to develop your own tactics of managing that. But I don't know whether there's necessarily a lesson on how to do that. You just have to figure it out. So I'd introduce myself to the company sergeant major, who was like a real character in the regiment, and his family had all served in the regiment as well. What you find is a lot of the county regiments, you'll have father, son, brothers, uncles all serving together. We had three brothers all serving at the same time with us. And so you do get a lot of generational service within the county regiments. And the battalion had been on a relatively testing kinetic tour of Iraq on Optelic 4. So they were already an experienced battalion. They'd gone then straight into a two-year residential tour of Ireland, where they were based in Ballykinler. And so there was a lot of legacy knowledge, whether it was from Ireland earlier, into Bosnia, into Iraq, now into Ireland again. And so everyone was really competent professional operators, and it wasn't a case of that. It was like a new sort of battalion. You were coming in and you were absorbing this collective knowledge that was already in existence. And obviously it adapted, because in those earlier days of the Iraq conflict, you had people driving around in Land Rovers with a bit of chicken wire and some sandbags. And yeah. There you go. There's your protected vehicle. Yeah. Whereas when I'm deploying, we're in Mastiffs. So they obviously started to really make these changes. And I think that was as a direct response of it's unacceptable to be sending guys out in light-skinned Land Rovers, or even, you know, the Snatch Land Rovers. Yes, they might have been okay for Ireland, but they were certainly no good for Iraq.
And they weren't even, those snatches weren't even good for Northern Ireland at the time. The IRA had EFP, explosive form projectiles that could penetrate them. So it was just, again, real bad decision to send them over there, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, even, do you remember what were the pin scours? So when I was in Bastion, we had to pick these jackals up, drive them down to Fob Price. And there was like a tarmac road, which was pretty random, but we were blasting down here, and then we're getting towards near Price, and there was one of those pinscowers coming the other way. It's like, who's driving that? You know, it certainly wouldn't be me.
Yeah.
But obviously, it's come a long way since then, and I think it was a real rapid sort of development, and that's one of the things that happens when you go operational, that things develop very quickly, and you notice that even in the kit and equipment in my short period in the army. When we were Brecon, we were going down to JJ's and buying all your own tailored webbing and this, that and the other that you wanted, whereas when we were going to Afghanistan, you'd get this black bag issue which had everything that you could want to buy.
When we were doing the warm-up, we talked about the levelling experience of Afghanistan, Iraq, and that's something we've talked about in previous podcasts. And I think that came about because in the Falklands, when the Falklands finished, the perception pretty much was the Parachute Regiment and the Royal Marines were the only ones capable of doing out-of-area operations, dismounted-type operations. I'm not getting into the arguments whether that's right or wrong. It's just, to me, that was the perception there was. And I think because of the volume of tools that were going through, everybody got a chance to do kinetic operations. And that sort of illusion was put to rest. But just go back to your experiences. What was your main takeaway from Iraq? Your experiences as a platoon commander there?
So, yeah, it was really interesting because we've been hearing on the news all the way through Sandhurst about how kinetic the operations were in Afghanistan. And obviously, like you mentioned earlier about how did my platoon sergeant support me, I had some incredible platoon sergeants who were sort of tempering that excitement and energy that the young officer brings through their sort of more stoic experience. And so they were sort of helping me to tailor the preparations for Iraq. And I was in Ireland in the last 6 months of Operation Banner. So this is a campaign that's been going on for 30 years. It's a lot of people's full military experience. But my experience of it was on the wane. They were getting ready to collapse all of the patrol bases up in the hills, and Cross Maglen was getting shut down. And so all of that legacy of everything that people in an earlier generation of soldiers experienced, I was there, but it wasn't the same. We were already focusing on Iraq. The lads had just come back from Iraq. That was what their current collective sort of memory was. And arguably, they were probably applying sort of a lot of that experience that they'd learned on the streets of Basra in Ireland, which, you know, there's probably another podcast in whether that's one or not.
But also you could argue that the great selling point for the British Army in Basra was Northern Ireland. So it's funny that then you're exporting TTPs back from Basra into Northern Ireland as a result.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, I think that, like, any of the Irish who were operational at that time would have been foolish to not take that on board, because all of a sudden you've got young lads, corporals, everyone in between who have got that combat experience and they're not afraid to use the rules of engagement. I mean, it was probably wise that it sort of ended when it did, because otherwise you get all these battle-hardened guys coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq and going straight into the middle of Belfast, and that probably would have been a recipe for disaster. But we were already focusing on Iraq, and so we started to do the training even whilst we were still out there. We were made aware that we were going to be operating out of Mastiffs, which was this brand new of American-built protective vehicle. So imagine like the Saxon that we had in Ireland. It was like a sort of newer version of that. You could put, I think, 8 blokes in the back. You've got 2 drivers and then a top cover gunner. But it was all being run off like thermal cameras, so it was pretty innovative at the time. And we were light roll as well. So whilst the unit, one Mercy and one Cheshire, was sort of switched between sort of armoured and light roll, at the point it was light roll. So it was a case of learning very quickly how to operate out of the Mastiffs, and knowing that we were going to be meeting them in Unkasar, which is where we were going to be based out of. So there was a mixture of things going on. It was, right, we know there's this massively high tempo of operations. We know we're going to be operating out of Unkasar in these Mastiff vehicles. But then we started to get trained in, like you said before, the tactics which typically would have been the preserve of your elite units. But the way that I saw it, like, all of the officers, whatever part of the army had been through Sandhurst together, so we're all pretty much the same. All of the infantry go through Brecon once they get to corporal and sergeant, so that's a pretty big leveler. And then we're all of a sudden, you know, being trained to do strike ops, and which they would normally only give to certain units. But I suppose that you've got to do what you've got to do with the resources that you've got. And once we got to Afghanistan, it'd be interesting to see where the sort of applications for, say, special forces or more special duties would have dropped off, because everyone was getting their full fill of combat operations at that point. And I don't know whether there was as much of a desire to go across to somewhere else, because you're already getting it, aren't you?
Well, it's interesting, because I did a podcast with a guy called Tom Satterley, who's a Delta Force operator, and we discussed his time in Afghanistan and the sheer tempo of operations for the Delta operators out there. And basically, we had a conversation along the lines of the fact that Delta are actually overtasked, and a lot of the tasks Delta were given could have fallen down to a well-trained infantry battalion. But it's that case of those guys want to get into operations, and they're actually not realising that tempo is not doing them any good in the long run.
No, absolutely. I remember the various things being talked about, how you could have different tiers of soldiers. So you might have like ground holding troops, which are one tier, and then a slightly more specialist tier would be those that are going out conducting deliberate operations, and then an even more enhanced tier that would be doing the really specialist operations. And but we saw that again in Afghanistan. It was a case of whoever's there is going to be doing the job. And there wasn't really like a delineation between, well, the chefs have got to do the cooking and, you know, the Rimi are doing the fixing. It's like, if you're there and you've got a weapon, you're part of the team. And we'll go on to that in a minute. But yeah, just in terms of Iraq, this was my first sort of taste of this combat experience that I'd been preparing myself for. And obviously at the time that we were doing our pre-deployment training, I think these 4 rifles were still in Basra doing the ground holding battalion, and they were in quite a lot of contact. So we were thinking, right, well, we're going straight into the cauldron here. But then as it became a bit like infamous for its political failing, and it's really important to note that our sort of military operations are an extension of political aims. So none of this is about the units themselves, but I feel that there was probably a bit of selling the lads down the river a bit from the government in terms of having them on the ground but not really giving them the support and resources to do what they needed to do, to the extent that there was arrangements made for that unit to be extracted out of Basra. I remember there was TV footage showing these militia vehicles lining the road, almost escorting them out of the city. And it must have felt pretty ignominious for them.
We did the same in Afghanistan, didn't we, with the Royal Irish Parachute Regiment? Oh, was it Musa Kala? That same sort of accommodation was made. And again, they were escorted out. Look, the optics of both those episodes were terrible.
Yeah, and I mean, there was a lot of knock-on effects with the US Marine Corps as well afterwards, because certainly I witnessed this firsthand, that just before the Charge of the Nights operation occurred, we'd been told to go up to the Cob in Basra. So we're sat there in our Mastiffs. So just to go back a step, the first half of our tour was very much framework operations on the southern border. We were trying to get out and do some patrolling. We were trying to interact with the locals on the port, because that had been the main seaport of entry for Iraq up until like our tour, at which point it sort of got closed down. So there was a lot of activity there. There was hangars full of vehicles that were getting shipped up to Baghdad. There was a couple of Rebro stations and a big prison camp there that we were in and out of. So we were doing a bit, but it wasn't kinetic. You'd hear a couple of explosions in the distance and maybe a bit of gunfire in the distance, but it wasn't anything directly at us. And then we got asked to, or told to go up to the Cob. And this was pretty much the time that Operation Charge of the Nights was kicking off. And that had come as a result of us, the British, leaving Basra, and the Americans and the Iraqis basically saying, well, there's a power vacuum, there's a security vacuum in the city now, so we're going to go and flood it. And it was almost as if we were a bit behind the curve again, because we'd been told to go up to the Cob. And then it was, right, all of a sudden the Americans and the Iraqis are going into Basra to go and control it again. Your company, you go with them. And we're like, well, what are we doing? Just go in there, show presence. And so it's like, okay. So we ended up just driving around the city a little bit initially. And the lads that had been there earlier saying, oh, yeah, that's where we had a firefight. You know, you're literally doing a battlefield tour, driving around the city. And we found ourselves based out of the Shatalar Hotel, which was quite an experience to go into there, because that had been a big part of a lot of the story of what had happened up until then as well. But it was almost as if it was a bit passive, and you got to be careful what you wish for, because obviously I experienced like more high intensity combat later. But there was an element of this young platoon commander, you know, with his newly trained platoon, and it might be my one chance at doing this on operations, and there's not really much going on. So we were out and we'd do a bit more foot patrolling in Basra, and there's a couple of cheeky moments, like when there was big firefights between the Iraqi army, the Iraqi police, and the Jaish al-Mahdi, I think it was, the militias that were fighting against them for control of Basra. But it wasn't directly us involved in it. I think that at this point, and this was in 2007, so it was when the parachute regiment were over in Afghanistan and it was all proper flaring up, and we were saying to ourselves, like, why are we here, we should be over in Afghanistan helping them lads out instead. And we soon got our wish with that, but it was a really good operational tour to get my feet under the table in terms of leadership, in terms of being a platoon commander. And I think that that's why it would have been quite disheartening if that was my only opportunity of doing that role. Fortunately, I got a second bite of the apple being the support weapons platoon commander in Afghanistan. But I mean, it must be quite saddening for those people that have come before me, been a platoon commander, and then not really had a chance to prove themselves on operations. Because a big part of what it is that we do. We do it because we want to. Mm. We want to be a soldier. We want to be a platoon commander. And that might sound quite alien to people that aren't in the military bubble, but it's a bit like being a footballer and...
You don't go on the bench, do you?
Yeah, exactly. You know, if you get a chance to be in the FA Cup final, you want to go and play it, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what it felt like. So.
I think that period of Iraq was strange because Operation Charles of Knights was actually a political and military humiliation for the British Army. I mean, the Iraqi president, he basically was not impressed with the way the British were handling the situation in Basra and pushed us to one side, asked Americans to go down. The brigade commandos on a skiing holiday at the time as well, I think, which didn't help matters. And really, I think that sort of was a sign that the British couldn't wait to get out of Iraq and into Afghanistan, where they thought there was a better war on. And there was an infamous comment by, it might have been Dannett at the time, said, use it or lose it. If we don't get ourselves involved in conflict, we're going to have huge cuts. And that drove a lot of why we ended up in Afghanistan.
It goes back to that the Clausewitz quote about military operations being an extension of political aims, because we have to realise that we are just doing the bidding of the politicians, and it's almost like having that wild dog that you want to let off the leash, but then you tell it off for like biting someone when you've let it off. If you're going to be a politician who wants to use the military, be prepared to let it off. You know, say, right, that's your angle, go and do what you need to do. Don't let it off and then not feed it or give it what it needs. It's got to be used wisely, hasn't it?
Well, absolutely. It's a balancing act, isn't it? But you've built up this experience and then you deploy to Afghanistan as a fire support group commander. And for listeners who don't know, can you give a breakdown of what an FSG does, the weapons it has at its disposal, and what that tour was like?
Yeah, so like I said there, we were in Iraq and... obviously all looking at Afghanistan. This was the end of my platoon commander for 2 years, so it was what comes next for me. And I didn't really want to go and do a staff job. I hadn't joined the army for that. And I was fortunate in my persistence to get the commanding officer at the time to let me become the sniper platoon commander, which isn't typically an officer's posting. And arguably, we were probably a bit rank-heavy, but, you know, I found myself there, and it was a really, really good experience. So when I was in the rifle company, the snipers, which had been operating in the earlier Iraq tour, had been absorbed into my platoon. So the legacy knowledge of sniping was in my platoon, and so I'd had quite a bit of exposure to that already with the L96 rifle. And at the time, this is when the 338 rifle was being brought into service. So all of a sudden, there was a real opportunity for me to take over the platoon and start preparing for that Afghan tour. So as your previous guests would have alluded to, this sort of period, it was like a 2-year operational rotation. So you come off one tour, you have a bit of leave, start doing some like general training, and then you go into pre-deployment training onto another op tour. And that was the cycle. So as soon as we came back off leave from Iraq, it was right, let's start getting ready. And we were going to Kenya, we were going to the Falkland Islands. And I'd been fortunately given the opportunity to take over the sniper platoon. And my tasking really was to try and get as many lads badged as possible ahead of the Afghan tour. So we had one badged at the time, and that was on the 338, sorry, on the L96. So, by the time that we deployed to Afghanistan in 2010, which was about 2 years, there was about 2-year gap between the two tours, we managed to get 14 guys badged. I went on the Sniper Platoon Commander's training course. So mine wasn't actually firing the weapon. It was more the deployment of the sniper pairs, either as an intelligence gathering asset or being able to do coordinated shoots or whatever else we wanted to employ them as. And it was a really good course to give me that grounding. And subsequently, there was a lot of opportunity to demonstrate just how potent the snipers could be, to the extent that by the time that we were deploying for Afghanistan, it was, rather than keeping the snipers as one formed unit, it was going to be pairs going to each of the subunits, which kind of left me without portfolio. But that, again, was fine because they then asked me to form an FSG or fire support group. And the reasoning for this was that the way that they'd broken down the Orbats to go into Afghanistan, my company, for example, was under the Danish battle group. And then the battalion headquarters was going to become a police mentoring unit. A company had gone up to Sangin. I think that they were the Royal Marines. And so all the companies have been spread across the AOs and attached to different battle groups. We would send the snipers with them. And I went to C Company again, which was my own rifle company. So it was fantastic. But like as a senior captain in charge of a fire support group. And it was quite an interesting way that it was done. They basically broke down support weapons company. And then a lot of the spare blokes was backfilled into the other companies. And so I ended up with a mix of quite new rifle company guys, and then probably the other half were really experienced senior soldiers, corporals. So I had quite a rank heavy platoon, but it gave us a lot of operational freedom and also the skill sets that they brought with them. So there was myself, and we had a sniper pair, I had a Remy mechanic, I had a javelin operator, I had quite a few heavy weapons guys that come across from support weapons. So it really gave us a full complement of kit and equipment, a lot of which we were learning for the first time when we got to Kuwait. I remember we were in contact from day one on that tour, and I was out on a platoon patrol around this little village, and we came into contact. It was the first time that one of the lads had fired the LASM, which was one of the handheld rocket systems, and it's, you know how to use that? Yeah. Just so there's nothing like a little bit of on the job training. I'd had a really good chance with the snipers to get them badged. I took them out to the Falklands so they could get all the windages and their elevations and collect data on, you know, high elevation shoots, low elevation shoots. In Kenya, we were able to operate and get the data for like super high temperatures. And that was all really, really useful for when we went over to Afghanistan, because they were operating independently as pairs, but they were as prepared as they could be to do their job really well. Some of the guys chose to carry the L96, which is a smaller, lighter weapon. And then if they were more static, they would be using the 338. So I'll just quickly talk about how we deployed the snipers, or how they chose to deploy themselves. The two guys that were with me, the first half of the tour when we were doing foot patrols, like I say, we were out in the green zone, and the guys would tend to carry the L96. And then when we were like operating out of the Jackals, they would use the 338 because they're not lugging it about. I know one of the pairs that was with a Gurkha company, they were primarily static, just providing 360 overwatch, and they could pretty much see the whole area that the foot patrols would go out on. So they were able to provide immense overwatch throughout, which, you know, gave the foot patrols real confidence. But obviously, it was quite a sort of target-rich environment, shall we say. And so the further experience as a sniper grouping that was gained from that tour, which it is quite geeky sort of sniping, and there's a lot of like technical maths and data collection.
It's also quite personal. And by that, I mean, if you get in a contact as an infantryman, chances are you might be firing into a compound, suppressing an enemy in a compound. You might get a fleeting snapshot at a running figure. A lot of time you might not see everything, you're just firing at muzzle flashes, for example. A sniper might have somebody's face clear in the sights. Was that ever something that was discussed on the tour? Was that a psychological issue for some of the guys, or was it just didn't make any difference to them?
Yeah, of course it makes a difference. I mean, I think that like you've identified, if you are looking directly at the individual you were just about to shoot, it's like the most intimate sort of connection that you're going to have with somebody, other than if you're in hand-to-hand combat, if you think back to some early historical anecdotes of snipers, and then you're watching your individual, you can be seeing all of their mannerisms, the movements, like watching what they're doing, whether they're on the phone,
You can see it really, really clearly. At which point, if you make the decision that they're a threat and they have to be removed, or that you're given the order to engage them, you're still going to see what happens to them as well. And I think that if you're firing a rocket at a bush where you think that there's an enemy, or you're engaging with a heavy machine gun, you're not really seeing what's going to happen. Maybe someone's going to go and do an assessment afterwards to see what's there. But it's certainly not as intimate as a sniper engaging with a target. And as we've said earlier, the things that you see in life, you can't ever unsee. And so I don't know what these guys have in their memory banks in terms of that collective shooting, because there's been a lot of recorded evidence of the numbers of targets that were engaged by snipers throughout the whole of the Afghanistan and Iraq campaigns. And there's a lot. And each of those individuals that's conducted that task, they have to certainly live with what they saw. But that's not disregarding the fact that it's a very key skill.
Oh, absolutely. And traditionally, you read about snipers in World War II and other conflicts. If they're captured, a lot of times they were summarily executed because they were a loathed aspect. They can be quite a, not just a kinetic effect, but they can deliver a real psychological effect. And I think you're seeing a bit of that in Ukraine with drone operators now. I mean, some of the intimacy of that footage you're seeing from drone operators, especially the FPV drones or the drones when they're dropping grenades on people out in the field. So I think there's probably a comparison there as well with the fact that a lot of drone operators, if they're captured, aren't getting much mercy from the other side too. So it's a very interesting comparison, I think, between the two.
And I know that in previous podcasts you've talked about the psychology of the contact, and like how you feel prior to a contact to how you feel the moment that that contact's initiated. And you walk along some dusty path waiting for something to explode under your feet. And yes, you get given a Valon, you know, to try and do some metal detecting. But if you do that to the drills and skills that you're told to do, you're never going to get anywhere. So you have to be a bit more connected to a higher power or some sort of fate instead, because you have to think, right, we've got to get on with this mission. And so that those psychological tools, and I suppose it's the same as most of these sort of like indiscriminate sort of psychological effects of weapons, the sniper being one of them. If you know that there's a sniper operating in the area that you're in and they're really effective, you're going to be panicking because you're not going to see them.
Yeah.
And there used to be people talking about like the enemy having snipers, and it used to really annoy the lads because like, they're not a sniper, they might be a sharpshooter. they've not done the British Army sniper school. So,
but going back to we were talking about Northern Ireland earlier, you had in the early 90s, you had the South Armagh sniper, and he killed about 7 people, including the last.
Did he have
in a barrel like 50? And I think he shot some other smaller calibers as well. But again, it was that psychological piece whereby it was sold as a Barrett 50 cal that was taking people out. And the locals are putting signs up around the different towns with "Beware sniper at work." And it had a psychological effect on soldiers as well.
Of course it would.
Yeah.
It would. And we used to hear on the ICOM, like the ICOM radios, you know, the ginger white man's out there, and he was an Afghan guy, and through whatever sort of had happened, you know, in earlier history, there was a white guy, ginger hair, who was like, you know, as Afghan as any of the Afghans, and he was supposedly connected with some guy that had a Dragunov sniper rifle. So he used to always get it on the ICOM. It's like, the ginger white guy's about, the Dragunov's about, and everyone started panicking. And yeah. You know, I don't know whether it existed or not.
There's obviously a snobbery among snipers, because I remember talking to infantry lads about the so-called South Armagh sniper, and they said exactly the same thing. He's not a sniper, because most of the shoots, I think, took place at under 300 metres. And they were going, yeah, and they could do that at a range. You know what I mean?
So, well, I mean, arguably with the optics that the weapons have nowadays. Going back to Afghanistan for myself, I had this really great opportunity to lead my men second time round. And this is where everything that you'd learn as a platoon commander, everything that I've been shown at Brecon that you thought was like World War II rubbish that you're never going to use again, it all came to reality. And that was the very much FA Cup final of being an infantry platoon commander, that particular tour. So it was a summer tour, incredibly hot. I'd deployed out a couple of weeks before the main body of our battalions sort of do a bit of a conco role. And I remember deploying out to PB Raheem, which is where we were going to be in the Upper Goresh Valley. And yes, there was a company location there and it had lots of sangars and all the infrastructure, but there was no one there. There was probably like sort of 10 Yorks blokes manning this whole PB. And it's like, well, good job that we were bringing a full company unit because they were doing an admirable job, but they didn't have enough blokes. And I remember going out on a foot patrol with one of the multiples. This was day one. In the Upper Goresh Valley, and going straight into a contact, and it was, I remember it vividly, obviously, because it was the first time I got shot at, but it was one of those moments that it happened, and then afterwards, even like as it was happening, I was thinking, oh well, at least I know now how I react in a contact, because again, it's one of those things that until it happens, you're like, will I jump into a ditch crying? Will I, you know, soil myself? And you just don't know, do you? And so
it's a common fear, isn't it?
Yeah, massively. Yeah. So it was great to kind of get that out of the way before my blokes turned up, because imagine if like I'd had my platoon turn up and then I got into that firefight and obviously started to panic or vomit or something, it wouldn't have been ideal.
Well, I laughed at your comment about you referring to Brecon at World War II training, because when we did a podcast with Adam, who was Royal Irish, and he describes a contact whereby one of his guys gets out of a ditch and takes a burst of machine gun fire to the legs. He falls into an irrigation ditch. He starts drowning in the irrigation ditch. They've got to drag him out. They've tried to stop his bleeding, medevac him back to an HLS. And Adam described that. He goes, it was like your worst day at Brecon. And So it does show that training, you might be doing it typing, this is bullshit, but actually has a value. It's just, we were both laughing, he described it as his worst day at Brecon.
Oh yeah, it's like every single serial that the DS come from.
Yeah.
Like, this is too unbelievable. So I've been there, done the conco role, company turns up, and then straight away we're out into framework patrols. And initially, because we had like a full complement of the company, you had three full platoons. So mine, even though it was an FSG, it was operating as a rifle platoon, albeit a pretty sort of rank heavy one initially. That changed later on once we started to get a bit of attrition within the company, which is why we only really had enough manpower to man the three vehicle FSG instead. But initially, we were going out into the green zone and we were actually doing company advanced to contact, arrowhead formation, straight out of Brecon. And like, you really realised why all of that training was so useful then, because it was about moving and using the ground and jumping into the ditches and using that. And there was all sorts of tactical leanings back to what we'd picked up in Brecon that we were applying on the ground there on a daily basis, because it was such a strange environment. Like, you had the green zone, which was quite heavily foliage vegetation, and then literally there's a line and then you're in the bare desert. So it was quite a stark contrast. But every time you went into the grid, well, pretty much every time you left the camp gate, it was a matter of minutes before you came under contact, and then whatever you were planning on doing that day has probably gone out the window and you're dealing with the firefight instead. I remember reading some article in the Sun newspaper after we got back saying it was our battalion had suffered the highest casualty rate since World War II, or I'm not sure how true it was, but we certainly lost 14 of our men got killed on that tour within that period.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans.
To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Period. And I think that it was such a trauma to our collective consciousness as a group of people that sort of bonded that group of people very much and always will do. But also we lost probably 50% of the battalion was a casualty in one way or another. And that was just the sheer number of IEDs and chaos and, you know, non-battle injuries and stuff that was going on. It's a really hot summer as well. And you'd be walking around like a big, you know, rock with this giant body armor on and people are overheating. And we used to get guys and you go out on a patrol and within 300 meters someone's overheated, and then you've got to do a full CASEVAC on them, and it's quite labor intensive going through that type of patrol schedule in that heat.
I've got a question for you, Lawrence. Soldiers on vehicles, or armored vehicles, you always talk about firepower, protection, mobility. Pick any two. So if you have firepower and protection, you can kiss away mobility, and that's in essence what happened to the light roll troops over there. They had firepower, they had the protection of the body armor and all the rest of it, but it really hampered the mobility. And I did an interview with a guy called Jimmy Warren, a friend of mine, who was on Mount Walden with 3PAR. Mm-hmm. And I asked him about this. I said, back then, if you guys could have had all the body armor and all the rest of it that the guys had in Afghanistan, would you have had it? And he said, no way. We needed that mobility. We had guys on the final attack with, like, dumping the web and just sticking all the magazines in their pockets to get through all the rocks and fight, do the fight through. Looking back on it now, would you have preferred to have gone a bit lighter and done away with some of that protection? Would that have offered you anything? Or do you think what you carried at the time was suitable for the tactical situation you found yourself in?
I totally agree with the sentiments of your previous guest, and I think that we were operating against a group of people that were running around in flip-flops with an AK. You know, they knew the ground and they were really agile, and so they could cut about a lot quicker than us. And they used to call us on the scanner, ICOM scanners, the rocks. Oh, the rocks are out on patrol, because we look like giant rocks, didn't we? You know, you're weighing down by an extra 30 kilos of weight. It's really constraining. So even if you're running across an open area, like, your lungs aren't getting to full capacity because you can't breathe properly. You did get used to the body armor to an extent, even in the heat of summer. But it's always a trade-off, because I was listening to another podcast the other day about the Americans, and they basically had made this ruling that if anybody was out on patrol and they got injured, they have to put on the casualty identification card what parts of their body armor they were wearing. So that meant that they had to wear the collars, the shoulder protectors, or the groin protectors. Now, fortunately, we didn't have to, you know, do that. We just had the plate carriers. But you could go too far, couldn't you? And, like, if, you know, they're going to start punishing people because there's this such risk averseness.
Yeah.
That is a problem. And, you know, politically, we were quite risk averse, and it was the optics of the coffins coming back on the back of the C-17s with the Union Jack flag on them. But when we look at sort of current threats today, again going to Ukraine, that is very much an attritional war, where if you had that appetite towards risk, you'd be out of the game in the first day, you know. So
It's horses, of course. And I remember reading one time that in the Israeli Defense Forces, I think the type of body armor you wear on a specific operation is down to the battalion commander. Mm-hmm. So if you're going on a recce patrol, say, you might not wear plates. If you're fighting in defense, you might have everything on. You know what I mean? It's that scalable assets, and I think down to local risk assessment.
It is, because, you know, what you can do is degrade your performance because of the health and safety requirements. Because if you put a glove on, you haven't got that tactile feel. Doesn't matter what glove you give someone, you can't have the same touch sensitivity as if you've got bare fingers. If you're wearing glasses, eye protection, yes, it's going to protect your eyes in the case of an explosion, but you have to counter that, the fact that it's going to steam up every 5 minutes. In terms of the body armor and the helmets, etc., you've got heat exhaustion that you've got to consider. So there's always going to be pros and cons to anything that you do, and I don't think that there's probably a right or a wrong answer. Going back to the FSGs, though, I absolutely loved operating out of the Jackal because it was open-topped. So in Iraq, we've been in the Mastiffs, and you were literally looking at a screen, like a little thermal screen, and it had no depth perception on it, so you didn't know whether you were 10 metres or 20 metres from that car in front of you. In the Jackal, yes, you didn't have that protection if someone's going to start shooting at you from a higher elevation, but you could see everything. And from first-hand experience, they could take a blast. Unfortunately, they couldn't take a blast for everybody, and like a lot of people did get hurt in them, and it's really unfortunate that an IED that sort of kills one full crew just knocks the wheels off another vehicle. And I don't know why, what the rhyme or reason is behind why that happens, but I know that in terms of it being a protected mobility against IEDs, it certainly did its job for myself. And so to have that all-round awareness that the Jackal vehicle gave us, it was phenomenal. And so just going back to the Afghanistan experience, like after we sort of switched from doing the foot patrols in the green zone to your proper sort of FSG role, we would find ourselves operating out of these three Jackals or two Jackals and a Husky, depending on, you know, how many of them we'd blown up that week. But they were certainly a formidable weapon, and the ability that it gave to the foot patrols out in the green zone to have that overwatch gave a lot of reassurance, because you can obviously carry a lot of water, you can carry a lot of ammunition. We could carry several Javelin missiles. You could have a GMG or a HMG on the top of each one, plus either the GPMG at the front for the commander. So, yeah, they were a really formidable weapon. The biggest risk to them wasn't someone engaging you with small arms, it was the IEDs, and they would place them in the most random, like I'd be using my sort of like most random thinking to say, right, how am I going to get from A to B? Well, I'll go here, zigzag, zigzag, up, down, and no one's ever going to think that I'm going to use that route. And I still hit an IED. It's just like, come on. And they'd be in the middle of like nowhere. So that was a big risk, the IEDs, but as long as you didn't like hit an IED, they were able to give such a level of support to the rest of the company group. And so just going a bit more into what the FSG does, it's exactly that, being able to operate as a mobile platform to push out to high ground or to an overwatch position. And it gives your foot patrols a lot more freedom of movement. So if we knew that the patrol matrix for one of the call signs was going to go towards this particular area, we could fly up there beforehand or just at the right moment to provide that overwatch. And on quite a few occasions, we would catch out insurgents setting up ambushes for our guys. And it sounded quite surreal because we had really good comms on the platform. And you'd be relaying back to the ops room saying, right, we're looking down at this particular location. We've got eyes on three guys clearly setting up an ambush. And then at the end of the day, once it becomes a risk to the other individuals, that then is when there's a threat to life. And so you're able to engage these targets and you had this full array of weapon systems that you could engage them with. And so you've got the HMG and the GMG, which are a bit more blunt force, although you could aim them to an extent. But then you had like the more precision sniper rifle, and then even on occasion because of the line of where the sun was, if that's affecting all of your other optics, we would use the Clue, which was a thermal weapon system, and this thing's designed for engaging tanks and anti-armor weapon, and it can do a direct or top attack like approach towards the target. And it might seem like quite a lot of overkill, but you can only use what you've got at your disposal at that particular time. And so if it was only the clue that could actually positively identify the target and you can confirm that it is a target and it's about to engage one of your call signs, then clearly the javelin is the suitable response. I think it's quite interesting because a lot of the weapon systems that we were using in Afghanistan, they were designed for the type of conflict that we're now seeing in Ukraine.
Yeah.
And they probably weren't as effective against a big, thick, clay, hard-baked wall.
And but do you remember how effective those walls were?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I remember seeing like maybe 5 or 6 LASMs being fired at a wall. And it's just like, didn't ring. So... But now they've come into their own because they are designed for the type of stuff that you're seeing in the Ukraine. And I think that the other interesting point to note on that whole experience in Afghanistan was that it was proper combat operations and it was a real leveler. But it also highlighted that there was total equality within all of the units, whether it was male, female, it didn't matter. And we'd be going out and patrol whoever's available. I had medics that were young females. We had dog handler. We had a JTAC. This is why there seems to be a lot of focus on gender and in the infantry and stuff. It's like when we were out on operations, it's whoever's there is going to do the job. And they all did the job very, very well. So,
yeah. Just as long as the people meet a standard, it doesn't matter what sex they are. As long as they're capable, that's what you're after, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, it's probably become a little bit politicised because everything does nowadays. But
it's very rare you can have a discussion about it. It always ends up in an argument. And I just think it's remarkable that I joined the army in 1985. I left in 2007. And the changes in the army between now and then were only good. You know, you kicked out for being gay when I joined up. If you're a woman, you weren't allowed anywhere near the front line. But we had female soldiers in Northern Ireland. We'd be there in helmets and walking around, and we'd have a WRAC or an RMP female soldier with us, and she'd be in a skirt with a soft hat on. I mean, absolute barking mad. Yeah. as if an ID went off, you know, she'd have a little bubble round her that wouldn't affect her because she was female. And they were taking the same risks as us. It's barking.
Yeah, I mean, everything's come along a lot now, though, hasn't it? Because even when we were in, that was 15 years ago now, pretty much. I did go back again, but it was like a lot different that time. But, you know, in 15 years, you'd expect that if that trajectory had continued, we would be in such a different place again by now. But I think that when you're not on operations, everything sort of slows right down. It becomes a bit, you know, it's a completely different task to try and manage an army. Yeah, and doing like, you know, little short-term tasks in comparison to the experience that I had.
Well, thanks to that, Loz. It's obviously you've got a lot of operational experience from what we discussed there. But how did these operations affect you?
Well, I'm not going to lie. You know, that sort of tempo of operations is going to have a bit of an impact on anyone. And I suspect that most people that were operating at that time period would have been impacted by the traumatic events. And when we talk about stress, it's a bit of a funny one. I remember seeing like lads throwing up before going out on patrol, and you're trying to motivate them to keep going, to get them out the door, to go into what is most certainly going to be a firefight within the next 10 minutes. Some people, they're doing that on the point of the patrol base. Other people would come home off tour and instantly sort of collapse. For me, I think that I found that the traumatic effects of the stress and the combat experience came a little bit later. And I liken it to like a glass that it gets filled up, and this is your stress glass, and it gets filled up through normal stuff, whatever. And then when it gets to the top, you either need to be able to empty it or it's just going to keep overflowing. And if you get to the point where it's overflowing, it'll just overflow at the smallest little incident, things that previously would have just been inconsequential. And that's where I got myself to. So it might have been as a as a side effect of, you know, being on operations, or it could have just been normal life. I don't know. It doesn't really matter. I just know that the stress got too much for me, and it all became a bit like challenging to handle. And so I've spent a great deal of my time since then understanding trauma, understanding post-traumatic stress disorder, and understanding how to manage symptoms. So even though, like, I had a lot of the characteristics of PTSD, I know for myself personally, it was this overwhelming sense of rage, and everything would cause me to go into a rage, and a completely irrational rage as well. And, you know, don't get me wrong, it's not perfect now, but I've come a long way in managing that, because you realise that it's a problem. And if you're self-aware enough to see that it's not how you were prior to that experience, then you can understand the difference. And I think it's our personal responsibility to figure out how to fix that. It's not fair on your family or your colleagues or anyone else to just take it out of them and be a bit of a victim. You've got to say, right, well, something's changed. It's probably because of this, although that's not actually as important as identifying that there is a problem. Right, what am I going to do about it? So I did leave the army, and it was primarily because of this stress. But I didn't feel that I had the help to fix me and help me to recover at that point from the normal channels. And so I spent a great deal of time in introspection, figuring out what it is that I needed to move me forward to the next part of my life. And I've taken a lot of influence and inspiration from big organizations, small organizations, self-help books, spiritual practices, whatever it is I needed to kind of build this vision of what would help me. And by working within that charity, third sector, specifically within the veteran community, you realize that there's an absolutely thriving ecosystem of organizations that'll cater for every single thing that someone could wish for when, you know, leaving the military for whatever reason. And so that's why we're at a point now. And I think it's primarily because of that generation of individuals who've experienced it and thought, right, the help's not going to be given to me. I need to figure out what I can do to help the wider community. And, you know, you've got guys like setting up pathways into logistics, mental health support, like homelessness support, everything that you can think of now that you may require as a transitioning soldier, whether or not you've decided to leave under your own volition, or you've had to leave because of the experiences you've had, there's things to help you.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting because you sent me the findings of an ONS study that said armed forces veterans between the ages of 25 and 44 had a higher rate of suicide than men of their age who are not in the forces. It's quite a shocking statistic, but again, we're slowly getting there, because the podcast I did with my friend Neil, who was involved in that contact in Northern Ireland where two of our mates were killed, he realised he had a problem, but he was so ashamed of it that he made an excuse that he was going to the military hospital to see about a leg injury. But he told me something in the podcast that I never ever knew about, and he was getting a psychiatric referral. And one of his first appointments was with a lieutenant colonel from the Royal Army Medical Corps, and this is 1989, 1990. And the colonel basically turned around and said to him, "You need to get a grip. This is what we do."
Mm.
So you think from 1989, 1990 to now, we've made incremental steps. It's not as much of a shame to talk about these things, but there's still a long way to go, and people can come to a tipping point. And what I'd just like to ask you now is, the tipping point for a lot of people was that Afghan withdrawal, that very messy Afghan withdrawal.
Mm.
What were your thoughts on that, and how did it sort of affect you?
Well, I think it ties in quite considerably with the new study that's come out in terms of veteran suicides, because I know that we've been trying to, as a nation, push that up, maybe from a political perspective. But the ONS is like the Office of National Statistics, and it all sort of just gathers data, doesn't it? And how we use that data. So therefore, the facts are presented to us. Just to give you a few facts on the withdrawal, it's like they reckon that the US estimated to have spent about $1 trillion on the Afghan campaign for that 20-year period, and probably another $1 trillion on the welfare of those returning troops. They had about 350 KIA, but you know, we are very aware from anecdotal evidence that there's veteran suicides in the US on a daily basis, and it's proportionately higher than what is occurring in the UK. But that study that prompted the ONS findings, it was saying that between 1996 and 2018, that there was 1,086 veteran suicides in the UK. And from personal experience, I know that that's increasing on a pretty regular basis. A year or so ago, it was like almost one a week that people were succumbing to their demons. There's no excuses about it. Going back to what you said about the doctor, I got diagnosed with PTSD in 2014. And I remember the first time I went to the doctor in the military. Oh, we only deal with physical ailments here. We don't do that mental health stuff.
Still.
Yeah, and that's what I got told. So that's why I didn't really have a great deal of respect for the whole military therapeutic system.
Sure.
And I went and looked at different things. I think that Afghanistan is going to have had a massive impact because it's a whole generational thing, because we've been there so long. And you can tie in Iraq with this as well, because that whole generation of military people, both here and in the US and all the allied nations, have had their whole careers there. It's like, it must feel a bit of a kick in the teeth for most people that people have fought, died, grown up, lost friends, lost their mental health in this country. And then at some spurious moment, it's been decided that we're all going to leave. Mm-hmm. And it was even happening, like you said, about in Musa Qala. And then afterwards, you'd see Sangin was like given back to the Afghans, and therefore the Taliban took back over. And it's been a repetition. And the withdrawal from Kabul, I didn't really want to acknowledge it at first that like that had happened, especially in such a way that was so reminiscent of the fall of Saigon in Vietnam War. You'd think that the Americans would have learned a lesson on that. But it happened. And we must have realized, just by looking back at our own forays into Afghanistan, that it's a landlocked country. If you don't plan your extraction properly, then you're going to be dealt with a lot of issues. And that's exactly what happened. And there's documentaries on the TV now. And it's like, we can try and put a rosy spin on the withdrawal and say we rescued X amount of people, but how many did we leave there?
Yeah.
You know, in what state did we leave that country? Is it worse now than it was? Because all that money that was getting siphoned off, where's that gone? It probably empowered the very people we were trying to remove.
Absolutely. And
you can understand why a lot of people would be very bitter about the way that we've left Afghanistan. And I suppose that part of me never really believed the politicians. Maybe it's the cynic in me or whatever, but I remember speaking to the lads before we went. And obviously I knew it was serious business and there was a risk that some of us wouldn't come home. And I said, this isn't necessarily about Queen and country. This isn't necessarily about being patriotic. This is about us being the right group of people to get as many of us back as safely as possible. And if we stick together and we do the right thing, that is sufficient reason for us to go. And I remember saying that to them before we deployed, and everyone was in agreement. Because if you're under any illusions saying, oh, we're going to Iraq for the weapons of mass destruction, or we're going to Afghanistan to whatever it was we were supposed to be there to do, it's going to be quite a betrayal when that thing doesn't occur.
Yeah.
But it's entirely naive that the planners organized for us to invade Iraq and Afghanistan, but without a single consideration to how you get out of there. It's like a pretty basic rule, isn't it?
Yeah. Don't start some you can't finish.
Yeah. Just not, yeah. It's like, it ties in with that political end state thing, which is, know why you're going. Set the scene for your troops. Give a mission command and say, go and do this. And when you've done that, this is how you're going to come home. And everyone can kind of...
And we'll look after you when we get home.
Yeah, and I mean,
that's logic covenant, isn't it?
Well, I mean, they like to give all this spin about the Armed Forces Covenant, and I think people are questioning what that actually is, and I've never really been a believer in that either. It's like a bit of a tick box exercise for companies to say that they do something. That maybe, again, me being a bit of a cynic, but I think that real action is completely different to platitudes, and so when I look around the country now, and from you doing this podcast, which is passing that information to people, to the grassroots level organisations that are occurring and springing up right across the country, we are our own community. And I think we've accepted now that no one's going to come and help us. It's time for us to help ourselves. And if that's what it is, that's what it is. But it's a bit sad, especially when you compare yourselves to like the Americans and the support that their veteran community gets. But I mean, it's a difficult one, isn't it?
You mentioned earlier, Lawrence, about the military looking after its own community and doing things for themselves. And you're very much doing that now with Cockleshell 22. Can you just talk us through how that came about in your post-military life?
Yeah, so I mean, for me, there's not really a separation between those people within the military community who are serving now and those who have served in the past. I think that there's always a synergy. The mindset's the same, the people, the way that you operate. And you hear the old adage all the time of veterans just want to hang around with other veterans because civvies don't understand them. And I think it's quite true, really. And so a big part of my sort of post-military career has been trying to create these different initiatives into supporting transition, supporting life after the military. I created a program which helped ex-military move into new careers in the construction industry. And I thought that was really important because it kind of mirrored my own experience of thinking, right, what do I need now? I've stabilized my traumatic after effects in the military. I need to have a career that exceeds the passion that I had for the military, because if you just get a mundane job, you're not really going to be satisfied. So it was trying to identify things that would really be useful for the military and the transferable skills that they got. So that got set up, and I'm a bit of an initiator rather than like someone that sustains these enterprises. So that was set up and it's still running and doing great work. But then I looked at like my own life and then what others like me might be requiring. And it's kind of like more of a maintenance piece. How do you maintain your well-being in a post-military life? You've got your income sorted, your family sorted. What do you personally need? And that's where Cockleshell 22 came from for me. And it was like a connection of sort of like this absolute passion for military history that I have, this desire to be a leader, this desire to be with other like-minded people and do adventurous activities. And so I was talking to a couple of former bootneck mates, Matt and Steve, and we were discussing what we could potentially do that was quite cool. And I do a lot of expeditions. I've always been quite open about what happened with me when I left. And so, well, we could go and pay for us to go and do one of these expeditions off the shelf with like a travel company, or we could pick one and recreate it. And I don't even know how it came about that we decided to pick Operation Franktum, but we did. And so over probably a year and a half period, and it took a lot of work, we put together an expedition based on Operation Franktum, which was a raid into Bordeaux Harbour by a group of commandos on little folding canoes. They'd been dropped off in the Atlantic coast by a submarine, HMS Tuna. And then they covertly paddled inland to the harbour, set some charges on the German shipping that was like blockade runners at the time, and then they got away on foot. It wasn't a particularly successful mission. They blew up a couple of ships, but they got refloated within a couple of days. Only two people made it back to the UK. Everyone else was executed or got killed. But in terms of the morale boost for Churchill, at a time when we were pretty impotent, to say that we could still give Hitler's Nazis a bloody nose, that was the morale, that was the purpose of it. And so we were able to recreate this route pretty authentically in December, which is the first time an expedition has been done at the same time of year for the 80th anniversary. And we had some really interesting characters popping up to see what we were doing because of what that raid and that group of people went on to form afterwards. And so everyone was happy. We raised a load of money for Help for Heroes, the Royal Marines Charity, the Royal British Legion. We had a BBC film crew out filming us. And it was, wow, this has been incredible. And what an experience. It gave me and all the other guys this like purpose and meaning, this sense of mission that perhaps we hadn't had since we'd left the military. Mm-hmm. And it was just an incredible opportunity to do something really cool, honour these incredible people from our military history, and just raise a load of money for charities that we knew would be using that money wisely to help others. And so as a consequence of that, it could have just been a single one-off event, raise a load of money, and we raised over £40,000 for these various charities. We could have just done it as a one-off and left it at that. But then we thought, well, you know what? We've had a really good response from the wider public across the UK to this. Why don't we form this into a social enterprise and keep delivering this? And the mission is for Cockleshell 2-2 to provide funded or part-funded places on overseas expeditions based on World War II military raids. And so this is targeted at the armed forces community. And it's an individual who perhaps just needs that little bit of a spark in their life, but maybe they've not got £2,500 to go on this type of adventure. So if we can raise money through various means and give someone a free place or fund as much of it as they need, that's a good thing. And so there's obviously quite a lot of work that goes into setting up a social enterprise, and you've got to do all the marketing as well. It's a bit like being an entrepreneur, but not earning any money. That's like, you get all the challenges of a startup, but there's no like Ferrari at the end of the road. Well, you know what? You get a massive sense of goodwill.
Maybe a gold-plated Klepper canoe.
Well, it was interesting because the Klepper canoes came from the Ukraine. And so we bought Neris canoe kayaks for the expedition, which were kindly donated to us by various corporate sponsors. But the initial batch of kayaks that we'd ordered got seconded to the Ukrainian commandos because they were going to go and use them for something real time. And there was such irony in that.
Still amazing they used them in this day and age, isn't it?
Yeah, well, exactly. And it's like the Ukrainians were using the same sort of commando tactics that we were using under Churchill when he said, just go and set Europe ablaze. And that's that same methodology, which is, look, we're up against a more superior foe. So we've got to think a bit more outside of the box. And there's so many examples of these type of raids, like from the SOE, from the commandos. And I do want to note on this that the commandos isn't just the Royal Marines. The SOE guys was probably all of the misfits. Anyone who thought themselves a bit outside of the mainstream who served recently, you would have been in the SOE, you would have been a commando. And it's those guys that were volunteering for dangerous duties, they wanted to go out and just get stuck in, whatever it took. And most of these raids, Dieppe, it was pretty suicidal. I mean, we've just been to Norway to go and look at Op Gunnerside and Op Musketoon, both of which were where Norwegian saboteurs were parachuted onto a glacier. And they sneak into German-occupied territories, blow up power plants. The first one was where they were trying to disrupt the heavy water production, which would have led to Hitler having a nuclear bomb. The second one was for iron ore production farther north in Glomford. Well, in fact, Op Musketoon was, you know, really bad in terms of the escape, and it meant that quite a few of the guys there ended up in Colditz or getting executed because Hitler had brought out this
commando order.
Yeah. And not necessarily did every of these commandos know that was their fate if they were caught. But I suspect they probably still would have gone anyway. And so I just think that at this time in our nation's history, where everything's a bit chaotic and a bit confused, if we look back at the examples that are military historical figures gave to us, what commendable, what heroic, what incredible actions they gave. And so we're having great success in terms of growing our organization, Cockleshell 2-2, but also from a personal level, it's giving each of the individuals what they need to have a successful post-military career. Because it's like we're all cut from the same cloth, and we like that excitement. We like the banter. We like to be able to just get out and do something different to the norm. And a big piece of it for me was to try and do that inspiration activity. So if I, say, design the first expedition, that'll give someone else the confidence to go and design the next one. And so that's exactly what we're seeing. Now, the next big expedition that we've got going on is being run by Tom Rendell. Tom's a former Royal Marine who is absolutely fantastic and fanatical kayaker. He's most recently just won the world record for the Devizes Westminster kayak race in the folding kayak. So he's very, very passionate, very, very knowledgeable about the use of folding kayaks. Mm. And so he had an inspiration to take a group of Falklands veterans back down to the South Atlantic to recreate elements of the Pebble Island raid in the folding kayaks, but then also to do a yom across the island as well to go and visit some of the battle sites that they went on 40 plus years ago. And I sat in on one of the first meetings with these guys, and it was so moving because you've got a group of individuals, probably 60 plus years old, and they're starting to talk to each other for the first time about this campaign for over 40 years. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, were you on that Moody Brook at that time? Yeah, because I passed through there. And oh, bloody hell, did you know so-and-so? And you're like, wow. Yeah. It just moves you so much. And so Tom's sort of really gripped this expedition by the horns. And obviously he's got a lot of support from various angles, but it's a logistics heavy expedition to get the men and equipment down to the South Atlantic is a big challenge. So, I mean, if any of your listeners would like to get involved with sponsoring that particular expedition, that would be a really great conversation to have, because we'll do it by hook or by crook, and that's our methodology with this. But we just, obviously, we need some support. So if there's any sort of synergy with anyone else that would like to get involved with that, we'd absolutely love it.
So how can people find out about Cockle Shell 22 and maybe if you had something you wanted to sponsor or get involved, what's the best way to get in touch with you?
Well, I mean, we're pretty digital savvy people nowadays, and so we're on all of the social channels. And if it's okay for me to share the links in your show notes, that'd be amazing.
Absolutely, mate. Yeah, I'll put them in there. People can get in touch.
And cockleshell22, it's spelled like it sounds, cockleshell22.com. Go on to our site and you'll see some of our upcoming events and expeditions. And the thing is as well, this isn't a closed group. It's as open to you as to anyone else who's been in the military bubble. If they want to come down and get involved in one of the training weekends, come on one of the expeditions, that's exactly what we're looking for. We do quite a lot of work at the moment with a French production company who are helping to do a new TV series on commando raids. And so we're kind of a form body of men that can go and support like various film shoots, and that's quite important as well, because we have to become sustainable financially, and so we've always been looking at ways that we can try and raise them funds to essentially deliver our core activity, which is these overseas expeditions. So yeah, I mean, if anyone wants to get involved, is more interested in anything that the guys are doing, we would be more than happy to arrange that. So thank you very much for just letting me talk a little bit about that, Colin.
No, that's great, mate. One of the privileges of this podcast is the variety of people I get to talk to. And they've all got a remarkable journey in the respect that they go on operations, they have sometimes trauma to deal with post those operations, and then you find out how they deal with it, and then how they move their life on. And as a couple of guests said to me, you'll never get rid of PTS, but you learn to accommodate it in your life. That makes sense.
Yeah.
And I think too often soldiers are portrayed as unable to overcome these hurdles. And sadly, some people can't, but many, many do. So I think these stories are important to get out, that you can overcome these hurdles. You have initiatives like Cockleshell 22 that you're obviously pioneering, and there's other things going on out there that other veterans are getting involved with. So I think it does hold out that there is hope. And really, just before we go to the final hurdle of the podcast, What does the future hold for you, do you think?
Well, I mean, a big part of that maintenance piece you were just describing is and was the overseas expeditions, and that's what sort of drove me from a personal perspective to want to get involved in Cockleshell 2 too, because I think to manage my own sort of symptoms of trauma and the after effects of combat, it was like to have that annual challenge, and that was good enough for me to be able to do that. So I want to continue to be part of this fantastic organisation with this fantastic group of people, and I'd hope many of your listeners get in touch and get involved with us as well, because ultimately it's not my thing, it's not any of our thing, it's just our thing, and it's something that we've facilitated for the greater benefit of anyone who feels that resonates with them. And what if I get to do that for a few years, I'll be a happy person, because it gives me all of those things that perhaps my life was missing after the military, without the drill.
Nobody likes drill, mate.
The other big piece for me is I've been an ambassador for the Royal British Legion and Help Heroes for a couple of years prior to this as well. So I found myself in quite a good position of being able to advocate on behalf of veteran matters, and obviously to represent the veteran community in certain respects. And so I'll continue to do that as well. And I don't want to sound like a bit of a one-trick pony, because that's not the case. It's just that if you find yourself having an ability to help others, I think that's really important to do so. And that's a big part of my own healing, is to help others, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think having those experiences enables you to speak with a bit of authority as well, because a lot of time I've talked to other veterans again in the podcast, I've been in front of a civilian doctor, and they're like, you've got no idea what I'm talking about here, you've got no clue. And to have somebody who's gone through it and they can identify with, I think makes a big difference. So no, that's great work, mate. So as usual, we're going to finish off with Desert Island Debts, which is the guest choice of book, film, luxury item. So Lawrence, what have you picked for us today?
I've picked an academic military history book for my book. It's called The Mbenfu by Howard R. Simpson. Now, I read this initially in America when I had the great fortune of studying part of my degree over there. And obviously, the Vietnam campaigns are a significant part of their own collective consciousness. A lot of people won't realise that post-World War II, the British took Vietnam back off the Japanese, and they wanted to consolidate it to a position that they could give back to the French so they could continue their colonial possessions. And the French obviously were quite weakened after the war. So Britain was there, handed it back to the French probably a bit too quickly, at which point the Viet Minh were just saying, no, we're not having the colonial masters back. We've had the Japanese here, we've had the British here, this is ours now. Clearly that wasn't the case. But what this book talks about is the final battle when the French were defeated and pushed out of Vietnam. And it's such a heroic story. If anyone isn't aware of the campaign and the battle, please try and just learn a little bit about it, because it kind of captures everything that was romantic about that whole era and the end of it. You had a lot of Nazis and various sort of Second World War veterans looking for another fight and joining the French Foreign Legion. These guys were parachuting into pretty much certain death, volunteering to do so. And like, it also shows a lot about how you had this large conventional force who underappreciated what the capabilities of this peasant army had, who were dragging field guns up and over mountains, which was never possible, but it was, because that's what they did. And so it's the whole story of how the French overreached, were defeated, and ultimately had to leave Vietnam. So that would be my book.
And ironically, if I remember correctly, we trained a lot of the Viet Minh to fight the Japanese during World War II, didn't we?
Yes, and the OSS and the SOE basically is a big part of what they were doing.
Nuts.
It's ironic as well, isn't it, when you think about Roger Dean.
Everyone's connected, mate. Everyone's connected. So your film choice, mate?
Right, this is one that I'm not sure if many people would have heard this, but it's a Tom Hanks film called Greyhound. It's on Apple TV. It's quite recent. And it's probably the first film I've seen which shows about the convoy wars in World War II. The battleships having to bring all of the goods and the merchantmen across from the US. And there was this like big section of the Atlantic that couldn't be covered by air cover, at which point the wolf packs would, you know, sit and just rip them apart. And so the film's sort of covering that story of one particular convoy and one particular captain. But it's incredible. And
I've seen this good film.
And I suppose a big part of this as well is it's like when we're doing the Cockleshell expeditions, if you're in kind of similar environment with kind of similar kit, you can really empathise with what these guys went through in World War II. And I think sometimes we forget just how tough they were.
Yeah, it was a lot of basic equipment, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Right, so we're going to go to the luxury item. Now, I have to say, right, one that I've done 50-odd episodes, and as a tea drinker and former soldier, I'm just devastated at the amount of soldiers that come on here and say they like the coffee so much. So I've given it away now, Lawrence.
Yeah.
Go on. What's your luxury item choice?
It's a coffee machine I'm generating. A millennial is moving forward. But I'm not sure how it's going to work, because if I'm on a desert island that don't actually have any power, but have a nice coffee in the mornings and you set up for the day then, and that's...
No, I won't deny your luxury item, mate. I didn't even find the pillow sauce for you, so that can't be bad. So my book choice this week is Killing Thatcher by Rory Carroll. We've done 3 or 4 episodes on The Troubles, and I revisited this one because it covered a period or an incident I wasn't too sure about, and that was about the Brighton bombing in October 1984, where the IRA nearly came close to killing Thatcher and quite a substantial amount of the cabinet. It offers a counterfactual as well, which I'm a bit dubious about at times, but it does talk for one of the chapters about what would maybe have happened if Thatcher had been assassinated, and that's quite interesting as well. It also covers the life of the bomber Patrick McGee, who was released under the Good Friday Agreement, pyro tactics, techniques, procedures, the intelligence war, the dogged police work to track down the bombers. For example, there was 3,000 dustbins removed of rubble and dust that they sifted through. Everything was done on index cards. There was no computers really back then, no CCTV evidence. And it really was the dogged perseverance of these policemen that managed to track McGee down. And it was probably the most audacious attack by the IRA throughout the whole of the Troubles, so it's highly recommended. Well, that's it for another episode. Laws, thanks very much, mate. We've covered a lot of ground there and really interesting, so I really appreciate you coming on.
No, I really appreciate the opportunity to come and speak about my experiences and about Cockleshell 2-2 and just try and sort of get that message across that there's so much work that we collectively can do to support each other in this incredible community of people.
Absolutely. And as I said earlier on, we'll put those links to Cockleshell 22 on the show notes. Thanks again to you and your listener for your continued support and suggestions. Please keep them coming, and our email and social media links are at the bottom of the show notes. You can find us at all the usual suspects, including Instagram, Facebook, YouTube and Twitter. If you've downloaded from iTunes and liked the podcast, it'd be great if you leave us a review there or anywhere you get your podcasts from. And thanks again to Nick Beale for his continuing help and offering technical support for his company ISAR. I will see you next time on The Unconventional Soldier.
Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.